Blog Talk Radio.
Yeah, good evening. I'm Ellie Steele. And tonight we're going to discuss a book called The Finding of the Third Eye. And it's by an author named Vera Stanley Alder. It looks like it was a self-published book. And I got this from my friend George Dixon. And I don't know if this thing is probably not in print any longer. I wouldn't think so. Really, there's no publisher on this other than and actually, this is from the library of Maria Fix. I just noticed that. That's stamped here. So this is very, very special tonight. Very, very rare book. I hope you enjoy it. I'm going to read the introduction here. It's rather short, but it kind of sums things up a little bit. And then I'm going to skip right over to the I'm going to skip over a large segment of it and jump right into the third eye, which is the second part of this book. Yeah. After chapter 13, part 2. And we'll go through that. There's so many incredible things here in this book. Let's start. In the introduction. Are human beings potential gods, as they have been told, or are they merely the least of worms? The world today is a seething mask of contradictions. Life does not become simpler with each new achievement, and the average man, kept busy with the urgent process of existing, has little time for thought. Yet there are moments when looking out onto a world where appears drab, cruel, confused, very ugly in many ways, man wonders, if there are great heights for him to attain, why does he seem to know so little about them? And what has man been doing all these centuries? Why do disease and difficulties and dangers appear to have increased the more civilization progresses? There comes a time in the lives of many people when they earnestly desire to find an answer to these questions. They would know why they were here. They would know why they were here, what it is all about, and if they can learn to master circumstances instead of continually being a prey to them. They begin to master circumstances, they begin to make an individual effort to find out for themselves if there is really any rhyme or reason or any justice in life, anything to hope for or to work for. When a man arrives at this age in his life, it marks a very important crisis in his development. It is the moment at which he changes from a puppet into an individual and joins the honored company of the seekers. To his surprise, he finds that the number of these seekers is increasing rapidly and that, in fact, they are beginning to make their impact felt upon social consciousness. He soon sees the significance of this. And true socialism becomes possible when people recognize themselves as individual units of power, capability, and thought. Then there will inevitably follow a correspondingly important and congenial position in life for each one of them. There is an unfailing demand for either the competent worker or for those able to wield constructive influence, and all can fill one of these needs. And there is no other way to individual happiness. The general apathy and ignorance which are existed for so long has reduced living conditions to a chaos in which there has been undernourishment in the midst of plenty, barbaric wars and cruelties taking place under the wing of so-called religion, and a system of education which results neither in mental power physical fitness, good looks, nor happiness. Now, however, humanity is walking up in a wonderful manner to a recognition of its own failures, and everywhere there is widespread effort and intensive seeking going on in manifold directions. This effort is to be found not only among the leaders and teachers of the people, but among the people themselves. The public interest in health, diet, physical culture, spiritualism, and hundreds of other cults and movements show the beginning of a powerful wave of progress that may sweep humanity upwards to the peak of new renaissance of a kind the world has never known before. And there are many today already caught up in the throes of the birth of this coming renaissance. Now, remember, this book was written in 1960. So, and they are tormented by the desire to know more of the inner meaning of life and the hidden issues to which they are so swiftly moving. And one after another, they take up the challenge of life's riddle and join the ever-growing band of seekers. It is significant that this seeking should press into the realm of religious, psychic, spiritualistic, and occult thought, in other words, the inner unseen world of causes. Man realizes that science, which has dealt so successfully with the physical phenomena, has not yet succeeded in giving humanity any measure of happiness or safety. So he is at last determined to try to find his happiness by getting in touch with causes instead of effects, by seeking for the laws of truth, if any, which may lie behind the reactions of living things. He begins to sense the difference between knowledge and wisdom. Knowledge is the result of an accumulation of facts, and its tendency is through specializing to isolate subjects one from another. Wisdom is the deduction from these facts of useful laws, a process which can only take place by comparing the facts in one compartment with those in all others, thus giving a vision of the whole. When a man becomes an individual seeker, his first effort is to discover that he can of facts connected with that what he can of facts connected with the fundamental truths of life. He wants proofs. There are many people ready to admit into the world of inner research. He is faced with a long and complicated pilgrimage. Wonderful promises are held out to him. He is assured of becoming a superman with health, happiness, and power hitherto undreamt of and heard for him to comprehend. He asks himself if all this can be true. If so, why is humanity still wallowing in such helplessness? In bewilderment, he hesitates on the threshold of philosophy, spiritualism, Christian science, or a dozen other cults and isms. His inexperienced eyes are unable to detect the truth from the false and is at the mercy of many people who seek to enlist him for their own pet cult or who wish to make profit for themselves by trading upon his virgin curiosity and yearning. If he has a tendency to emotionalism or a love of the sensational, he will be an easy prey. How then is he going to escape from the many pitfalls and manage to keep upon the true path for an understanding and mastery of life? These chapters have been written in an effort to provide the seeker with a simple guidebook for this pilgrimage to truth, a concise and bird's eye view of the new universe which he is about to explore. Endeavors to help him to place each new discovery into its relevant position so that he will gather, while gathering his store of knowledge, may develop wisdom also and learn those few essential secrets through which he may attain the poise, power, and creativeness which will ultimately develop him into a superman. The seekers who acquire and use this knowledge will be the builders of the new and promised golden age. In this book, an effort will be made to sort out, summarize, and compare the ancient knowledge with modern science. Most of the statements made are capable of worldwide and extensive corroboration by trustworthy authorities and can be verified by any reader who will care to give the time to it. can satisfy himself by as many proofs as he has the patience and energy to seek and the intelligence to judge and sift. The quest after truth opens up an unimagined and wonderful new world to the seeker, who thrillingly and so full of reward and interest that it is not within the power of human speech to portray it. Only the fringe of this absorbing search has been touched in these pages. But even so, this book contains the recipe for turning an ordinary human being into a superman, one who commands the means of success, happiness, or personal fulfillment always within himself and irrespective of all circumstances. Chapter 1. Things as they are. Our first concern will be to take a survey of the present position with unprejudiced eyes. The unprejudiced eye is a much more difficult thing to cultivate than may be imagined. In fact, to most of us it is an impossibility. For generations, indeed for centuries, we have been thought brought up in a certain in certain grooves of thought, certain traditions and habits, until our brains become wedged in a confined groove and are unable to look at things from a new angle. When, however, after finishing our survey of the present position, we see around us the result of thinking in these grooves and realize to what a state of unhappiness, chaos, and muddle this has all brought us, we may in sheer desperation make the effort need to jerk our brains out of their rut and guard them against ever slipping back again. Truth can only be understood by one in a state of attention. Therefore, truth is not available to those in a slack condition of mind. They could not take it in. Truth is only to be found at the bottom of a well. It must be struggled for and sought after and come upon through earnest effort, through the stimulation brought about by suffering or striving, whereby the mind is prepared to recognize it. That is why truth appears always to be hidden, veiled, and guarded. Let us then try to look with new eyes at the struggling mass of inconsistencies when we are in the habit of calling that we are in the habit of calling civilization. Man has striven always for happiness, and he has sought to attain it mostly in one of the three ways: comfort, entertainment, and religion. But he has sought these things only in their outward form. Comfort for the body has been the first aim, while a comfortable state of mind has been the last thing considered, while the lack of it has reduced the victim to despair. Cleanliness has also been studied outwardly, but seldom in its inward form. We do not understand how to keep our minds wholly free from rubbish and poisonous material. Religion, likewise, has come to be mostly an external observance, while as for entertainment, it is poured in from outside, and the mind being required to make an effort to obtain it. All the same, we are told that mind over matter constitutes our real power. Therein is one of the inconsistencies. Let us find some more. In some countries, the state supports a church which tells us, "Thou shalt not kill," but is not adverse to sending us out to war in order to slaughter our possibly blameless fellow men. For this we are called heroes. Yet if we kill someone for a reason which seems good enough for us, we are no longer heroes, and we are hanged. Many of us are asked to believe in church teachings and the Bible, both of them containing a mass of contradictions, which no one attempts to explain. For example, Christ asks his disciple to carry on the work as he had done, saying, "He that believeth in me, the works that I do, shall he also do. And greater works than these shall he do. And these works referred to healing, prophesying, and clairaudience, which with the gift of tongues, power to the understand, power to be understood by all nationalities, the power to work miracles, to interpret dreams and symbols, and to have wisdom with the seven gifts of the Holy Ghost. Yet the state which supports the Church's teachings may imprison one for prophesying, and the clergy for should be cultivating these gifts, leave them entirely in the hands of those whom they consider ignorant and superstitious. Calling ourselves civilized, we produce a race which cannot compare with many of the most savage tribes in health and physique. Look around at the members of an average crowd of today and compare them with the Greek ideal or the early Egyptian and Assyrian bodies. Through unbiased eyes, we shall see that we are mostly misshapen travesties of what a human being should be. We cannot deny the prevalence today of imperfect bodies, unlovely vacant faces, ugly clothes, and primitive conversation. Surely a modern crowd's appearance shrieks of the wrongness of our present mode of living. We know the hospitals are full, so are the asylums, and who dares to tell us how full? So consider also that we are at present in imminent danger of a world war, which would let loose as much as beastliness and cruelty as ever existed in history. But even without war, man is being murdered daily in various ways by the terrible robot which he has reared under the name of civilization. This robot is running amok. It has mastered its creator for the time being and produced a clever system of keeping him in slavery. And much that is real, enlightened, and knowledge is gradually being eliminated from man's education, which is given to him in odd spoonfuls, having no apparent relation to each other. Through no fault of his own, he is under an economic system which causes him to spend all of his days in the terror and anxiety of being without means of support. If he works at all, he must drudge the whole week through, while many of his comrades are refused employment, and he is obliged to pay for their support. There is overproduction and yet difficulty in obtaining cheap food. Even in some countries, the danger of starvation, honesty, and purity are preached to him from one side, while pornography and sensationalism are showered upon him from the other. And every effort is made to soak him through and through with an interest in sex by means of cinemas, theaters, books, newspapers, through the type of food most cheaply obtained. He is never told the plain truth that a preoccupation with sex is one of the greatest deterrents to brain development. I didn't know that. Every effort is made to soak him through and through with an interest in sex by means of cinemas, theaters, books, newspapers, and through the type of food most cheaply obtained. I just read that. He is surrounded with mind-destroying noise, rush, and anxiety, until even the doctors are beginning to say that modern life will soon exterminate itself. As if this were not enough, he is furthermore at the mercy of the warlords who sent him out to murder and mangle his fellow men, even if he has the kindest character. In escaping this last horror, he is dangerously slaughtered. He is daily slaughtered in his own streets by his brother roadhogs, while they, in turn, pay millions into the hospitals to put him together again. Life altogether seems to have been expressly planned to prevent him from creative thought. He has been, until quite recently, offered no problems to solve. His entertainment has been put before him in the form of predigested sensationalism, mental baby food. Weary and half-drugged by this intensive treatment, man has largely ceased to recognize the heritage of his wonderful mind. He no longer knows why he should think or that there is that there is to think of what there is to think about. Here then is a pessimistic picture of life as it is today. Ought we be satisfied with the state of affairs? Is this indeed the whole picture, or is there a brighter side to it? Let us not forget the claim. That man is a marvelous creature, in spite of the fact, in spite of much that appears to the contrary. This claim seems not to be entirely without foundation. On every hand, we find clues to strange and tremendous foreign forces hidden within us, forces that, when properly understood and developed, could certainly lead us to unimaginable power and achievement. We glimpse these powers in such people as the imaginative genius, the child prodigy, the thought reader, the healer, and the clairvoyant. We hear of them on every side, and their existence is too well known to be disputed. There are many great men alive today whose achievements stand out in sharp contrast to the average. Is it that they are supermen, or that the rest of us are lagging far behind the point of development we should have reached? If we were to say lay any of them upon the dissecting table, we should certainly find nothing about them that differs in any degree from the average person. Where, then, is the key to the wonderful power and omnipotence that apparently may be every man's birthright? There is nothing to prove that he could not all attain complete mastery over our lives and fortunes and real ideal happiness, were he given this key, and had the will and the determination to use it. Had he this secret, instead of being, as we are, slaves to life, to our possessions or environment, ill health, bad luck, and the rest, we could be master and controller of all our circumstances and welcome with content and understanding everything that life brings to us. We are told that the secret lies in the use of understanding of a certain knowledge to which is given an insight into the inner laws and forces of life and the manner in which they've been to use them. This knowledge has always existed, but it remains hidden forever from all but the earnest seeker. For the last few hundred years, humanity has been passing through the slough of Desmond, or ignorance. The hour has already struck, which marks the beginning of humanity's emergence from that blackness. Men have suffered so long and for so long, so much for so long, through ignorance that at last the inevitable reaction has set in. We can feel this strange beginning to play with in subtle ways through all phases of life. We have reached a time where we demand to know, and to know for ourselves and through ourselves, and to weld that knowledge irrespective of authority. We refuse any longer to dance like puppets to the drugging jazz tunes of incompetent authority, and soon authority will have to pull itself together and follow the lead of the seeker. For there is widespread seeking going on every day, or everywhere, now for the happiness, freedom, and power which we instinctively feel will be ours when we have gained the prerequisite knowledge, or the requisite knowledge. And the knowledge is to be found hidden, waiting, and wonderful. Our first clue to this knowledge lies in the study of what is known as the secret wisdom. This teaching was always in the charge of those who were well equipped both to govern and teach. But in time, they neglected their deep knowledge in favor of the easier way, power through money, superstition, and material pomp. This resulted in laziness and effete degeneration. Their only hope of retaining hold on the people was to plunge them into ignorance also. Therefore, a systematic persecution of certain knowledge began by edicts, inquisitions, and massacres. And finally, their end was so thoroughly attained that from the highest to the lowest, the wisdom had apparently faded out. And fortunately, however, there are now, and always have been, those who would give their whole lives to the gardening and hiding of treasure so precious. Such people were the alchemists, hermits, early Freemasons, and many more. So the knowledge was not really lost, but only concealed and safely guarded from destruction. Humanity is fast approaching the day when, through patient struggling, it will have earned the right to this wisdom. In fact, some years ago, it was given out in part for those earnest seekers in the vanguard of progress to discover, and let us make all speed to gain for ourselves this rich heritage. Whether we approach the subject from a purely scientific viewpoint, from a common sense one, or from a religious view, we will find that science, logic, or a root form of any of the principal religions will lead us finally to identical truths. We will realize that if we are able to accept these truths, we will obtain a very satisfactory understanding of the working of nature and of certain rules which will enable us to control ourselves and our circumstances in a manner hitherto impossible. We cannot gain such valuable knowledge without making worthy effort, but if we persevere, there is no limit to the benefit we shall obtain. The earliest results received will be firstly a considered improvement and control of health and looks, a growing capacity for happiness, an inability to worry or fear, a gaining of popularity, and freedom from boredom. In time, when greater strides are made, there will be immunity from disease, conquering of fatigue, the prolonging of truth, and there will be a growing capacity for helping others, a mastery of sorrow and pain, and a development of healing power. A growing inner force will be felt, and people for creating, both for people creating and the carrying out of them. Neither does a tale end here. Very advanced students, such as the yogis, become unaffected by heat and sound, heat or cold, wounds and poison. They are able to perform feasts, usually considered as miracles, and they appear to have access to regions of wisdom and felicity undreamt of by us. And people of this type move about among us unsuspected. They do not advertise themselves. They are under a law which forbids them to help unless help is asked, or to forgive out knowledge unless it is sought and will be properly understood. They are reading and waiting for the time when a growing number of people sense their secret and beg their help. When the general public have sufficiently advanced, they will insist on being governed by people of such attainment, and then indeed will begin the coming golden age. Meanwhile, those who are anxious to forge ahead and prepare for the future will find in this book a broad survey of many sides of the subject, together with the first sample rules for the beginning of attainment. They are asked only to keep an open mind as they read, for only an open mind is big enough to contain the secrets of the universe. Chapter 2. I thought I was going to skip over some of this, but it seems to be, it's logically put together, and the jump sequences the jump sequence will confuse the reader, which is me. What modern science says: before we begin studying the ancient wisdom, we will find it very helpful to prepare our minds by taking a survey of the ground covered by modern science today. It will be fascinating to see how identical facts can be known under different names and reached by different methods. Both the ancient sages and modern scientists are agreed that everything in life is forged of vibrations, so that as we shall be obliged often to use this word, we can begin by defining it. We are told that vibration is the result of force or energy concentrated in some mysterious way and caused to vibrate, shake, or oscillate at different speeds. The composition of an atom, according to some scientists, is first of all a tiny vacuum round which this force of energy revolves at a vortex, just as the circles of the sun or a zodiac revolve around it. The zodiac contains the planets revolving within it, and the minute the zodiac of the atom contains also its planets, or electrons as they are called. And the difference between one subject and another is ultimately a question of rate of vibration. It is the number and arrangement of the electrons within an atom and the varied obsession of atoms into molecules which go to make up these vibratory differences. The disturbance in the atmosphere caused by a vibration sends out a ripple or air wave in all directions. As an illustrative smile of this, we can throw a stone into a pool of water. At first we see the hole which the stroke makes and corresponding to the vacuum to the center of the atom. Then we see the disturbance in the water created by the hole. Circle of energy which sets up waves rippling with speed out to an unlimited destination, and drop other stones in nearby, and their circle of waves will flow over and through the others, none however being destroyed, although they affect one another slightly. The distance between one ripple and the next is seldom the wavelength. We have in this a rough picture of what happens in the atmosphere and of the waves set up by light, sound, or any kind of object, anything, in other words, that vibrates. Low rates of vibration form the most static or visible objects, and we might say that they send out only slow ripples. Higher rates of motion between the rapidly flying particles form these tangible things, such as gas. These particles intermingle rapidly with the air, but often they do not move sufficiently quickly to penetrate through solids. Vibration. I would like to say here, the statements in this chapter are not intended to be scientific accuracies, but roughly suggestive for the purpose of our argument, as the facts of science are continually having to be modified or changed. We need not take them too seriously. The last word has never been said. Vibrations of a relatively low frequency are known to us as sounds. Higher ranges are known as heat. Sound and heat are fine enough to pass through certain solids. We know all about the ripples of waves caused by sound. Also we know about the electrical impulses through the wireless, and we call them wavelengths and know all their measurements And some of the wireless wavelengths are as much as 3 miles long. We might picture the... It's interesting, since this study was, this was written in 1960, so this person had tremendous knowledge and foreknowledge of what was to come. And we were all kinds of credit.
is so minute and rapid that it can
interpenetrate solids. So these ultraviolet vibrations pass right through the eye lens. The question now arises, have we any organs which can deal with those higher vibrations or the very subtle the substance of which they are composed and in what form they are contacted? These less vibrations are so fine that they use the ether as their vehicle instead of the heavier air particles. The ether is what identifiable substance in which the earth and all the atoms of the air are supported. Scientists are beginning to discover that there is more than one kind of ether. In fact, even perhaps three or four. The finest vibrations which we have yet considered are within the three or within the realm of electrical magnetic phenomena. These are the forces which man also contains within himself and which can be utilized through the mind. We must now inquire what organs man has then which to register these particular vibrations, embracing the radiation emanations which come under the general term of psychic. There are two small giants in the head which give doctors much. There are two small glands in the head which give doctors much cause for speculation. I refer to this pituitary body and the pineal gland. The former is a tiny double bean shaped body situated behind the root of the nose. It is poised so that it is very sensitive to vibrations. We know that it is in some way connected with nature or with nurture, bodybuilding, and in the nervous system. If it is some way connected with weather, if it is removed, all organic function ceases. If overdeveloped, it produces giganticism. While if underdeveloped, dwarfism is the result. The pituitary body has been called the seat of the mind, and its frontal lobe is concerned with emotional thought, resulting in poetry and music, while the anterior lobe is connected with more concentrates intellectual properties. The pineal gland is a tiny cone-shaped body in the middle of the head, behind and just above the pituitary. It contains pigments similar to that found in the eyes and is connected by two nerve cords with the optic thalami. It is said to control the action of light upon the body. And for these reasons, scientists have suggested that it is the remnant of a third physical eye. Men of learning, such as Descartes, have pronounced it to be the point in the human being where soul and body meet and the seat of intuition. That's the pineal gland. It is said that when for scientific reasons, the pituitary body and the pineal gland have become fully developed and stimulated. Their vibrations fuse and stir into life the mysterious third eye of man and the eye of the soul. Apparently, this activity provides the mind with a perfect instrument with which to work, a transmitter by means of which vibrations of very differing types can be translated, interpreted, and rearranged. And this gives him personal access to much knowledge of which he will speak later. Man can also become sensitive to the full chemical and magnetic emanations by the ether, and can see the numberless, thoughtless forms, entities, and creatures that the endless complexities and types of life which make up a vast world of teeming energies which in limited capacity or ordinary physical sight is unable to register. In a few people, there is a slight involuntary functioning of these latter activities, and we call them either clairvoyant or crazy. And according to our understanding, they can literally see the radiations and photographs in the ether, which are given off by almost any kind of body. We will study these in a later chapter, but just as the muscles and brains needs developing in an average person, so these organs of second light need to be their own particular training. Many, however, are born with a knack for their use in the way of any other type of prodigy. Got 15 minutes here. Difficult to read this long, sit here this long. But I feel I have to do it. I'd love to be able to stand up and just walk around the room here, but it's not conducive to that. So. Eventually I'll be able to do these Thursday night shows with a more comfortable format for me personally. But when a psychometrist holds an article to his forehead against the awakened third eye, it tunes into incomingly with the vibrations emanating from the article. And as these vibrations represent a certain picture, just as do our thoughts, he is able to describe the association attached to it. The emanation from an object are often so fine and numerous that they continue to be given off for thousands of years, just as with radium. The Egyptians knew all about the third eye and indicated it on the statues of their gods by a knob on the forehead. They trained people in the use of this psychic culture center in the temple of Maat, and the god Maat was vulture-headed because the vulture has a sight so keen as to be almost clairvoyant. And when people responded to this training, they became seers, or psychic, as we should say now. They could see with the trained third eye right through a body, as the x-ray does, and diagnose disease. All over the East, we find statues of historic men or women of wisdom with a knob or other mark upon the forehead indicating this type of achievement. Of course, there are some people who have this power today, but we do not understand its use nor how to train them properly. Consequently, their development has been left to chance. We have now reached the most subtle portion on the scale of vibrations which we are discussing. The question arises whether we have quite exhausted its possibilities, or whether there are still finer ones than those that exist in the ether, and if so, have we any means of contacting them? The sphere of thought next occurs to us, and we are told that thoughts are things, and know that each thought has its definite vibration. Because this has been proved, and the instrument has been invented by Dr. Baraduc of Bordeaux, which records through vibrations. When an intelligent person approaches this instrument, it registers a high speed and strong vibration. When a low type of imbecile approaches, it is the variation. The vibration is correspondingly feeble and slow. It has also been proved by experiment that by any act of will, the mind can cause objects such as metal levers to move have also heard of numberless causes of fakirs and people of that kind, having been able to prevent themselves from burning by fire, from suffocating when burned alive, from bleeding from wounds, and from other normal reactions. They can do this by being able to bring into action the power that the finer vibrations of the mind have over the lower ones of chemical matter. And at the same time, the same thing is done in chemistry through the use of electrical heat to split up, reorganize, or control chemical compounds. Sometimes people use these powers without knowing exactly what they are doing, nor what the result will be. And as in the case of some forms of mental healing, based on blind faith, such cases are a wonderful proof of existing possibilities. But at best, they are uncertain, sometimes only flukes, and often much harm is done through lack of further understanding. However, in curing some diseases, either by trance treatment or by mental healer, the fine vibrations of the mind act on the lower vibrations of the diseased tissue. This can be performed at the same rate at which that particular mind is able to visualize and concentrate. It may take hours, days, or weeks according to the medium or to the condition of the patient and the healer. However, we know that there have occurred many cases of instantaneous healing, a diseased and broken tissue being rendered whole in a flash of time. We have heard of such things throughout history, and they are said to happen at the present day in places such as Lourdes. In these cases, we have at last touched upon the finest and subtlest vibrations of all, those of the spirit, or the highest creative force. And such vibrations, being unhampered by the process of the brain, and operating at a terrific speed, can go through the whole process of cure so quickly that we cannot possibly follow its course, and the result seems to us to be instantaneous. With a great spiritual leader such as Christ was, works of this kind are possible, especially if the sufferer can tune in through faith or through the medium of his own spiritual vibration to the healer's actions. Christ encouraged us to strive for these powers of healing, which are not really supernatural, but are the result of an intensive development and understanding of the laws of the universe. The mind has power over everything that it can understand and visualize. Therefore, the first step of all is to study these arguments and theories and those facts which are supported by adequate testimony with a perfectly open and logical mind. If and when we become convinced of any argument or concept, we must tabulate it carefully and pass it on to a study of the next. In this way, we will begin gradually to discover what we really can know and believe. For instance, we can feel that it is impossible for us to prove for ourselves the truth of Christ's miracles or any other in the past. But actually, such things are happening every day, and every guide and foreman and a little inquiry will soon put us in touch with them, and our common sense will then enable us to separate the true from the false. The object of this chapter is to show that, although we may approach this subject from an angle of pure chemical and mechanical science, we shall still be able to work through to the final result, that there is a certain force controlled by our minds which can act more powerfully, more solid matter over solid matter than anything else, and that there is still stronger forces apparently outside of mind which can act instantaneously and miraculously. It is not enough to go on any longer weakly tabulating these things tabulated things as hypnotism, thought reading, or imagination, but must be better understood for what they really are. We must have an explanation for the changes in tissue and matter which occur. The old alchemists claimed that it was possible to direct a mental force to change the composition of atoms by altering their vibration, and that thereby it would be possible to make gold. And they believed it was so, but already materialism had stepped in, and they often endeavored to accomplish it by chemical means alone. The only real power to do such things lies within ourselves, but we must first learn to use our own slightest, highest vibration. These powers can only work if they are undisturbed by the inharmonious heavy vibrations which enter into our composition if we live out of harmony with the laws of nature. The athlete knows that alcohol, smoking, imbalanced diet, working, and lack of sleep upsets his health and undermines his stamina. So that even the low vibrations of physical strength and steadiness cannot gain control. The mental worker knows that he has to steady down all his bodily disturbances and vibrations before he can concentrate at all. He needs not only to be able to ignore the vibrations all around him, which he can only do if they are steady and imbalanced. A hum of a traffic disturbs many, much less than odd drops of falling water, but also must have steadiness and balance of every activity of his own body so that he can ignore it. If, however, he is seeking never neither athletic nor mental expression, but inspiration, he can only obtain that by steadying down the brain itself, so that balancing its vibrations to the same state of poise as those of his body, he can ignore the brain and reach from the subtler forces of the mind. And the greatest inspiration will flash suddenly into the brain at a moment when it is quite and quiet and receptive. And therefore, although the highest vibrations are most powerful, we cannot get in touch with them within ourselves when our bodies and brains are a mass of struggling, fighting, inharmonious vibrations, as is usually the case. Though the highest forces are there within us, we give ourselves little chance of linking up with them, and consequently, we are unable to utilize them. I got about 2 minutes left. I think I can finish the page here. The yogis and fakirs spend hours in meditation or the effort to question down every activity in the body and brain so that the aforementioned positions of the latter, the pineal gland and the pituitary gland, can tune in to those highest powers. And when this is accomplished, these men can, while in that state, cure their own and others' bodily or mental ills, obtain inspiration or wisdom, and attain a high state of physical fitness and strength without our methods of exercise. The first thing for us to do is, therefore, to eliminate all the inharmonious vibrations from our body and brains. We must throw them out one by one, with discover them, and every unnecessary act, thought, emotion, and fear must go. We must build into the I got about a minute left here. The simple method for doing this will be explained later. Before closing this chapter, let us give a thought to the modern scientists, having followed a long trail in their efforts to discover the differences between matter and life which pour through it. They have finally arrived at the perplexing result that there is no difference at all. And they now know that the solid matter in its special analysis is merely energy or a certain state of motions. And they also know that our thoughts are also energy in a certain state of motion. And with that, I'm going to leave us tonight, because I got 26 seconds, but I won't be able to finish the chapter. I won't be able to. In other words, the words appear to be made up of the energy of the being, or the scientist, or rather some said being. We're going to end in 8 seconds here, so I want to wish you good night before we lose you. But I'm going to continue this final reading here for just a minute. Man behind it, whose idea it was, the scientists do not put it in this way yet. And from a scientific point of view, they have come up against a blank wall, and they present their present attitude is possibly that of a big question mark. And from that, we've ended the show, and I want to thank you. That reading tonight was from The Finding of the Third Eye by Vera Stanley Alder, and very interesting book, very old book, in that I believe it was may have been self-published, it kind of looks that way. And but some remarkably well written and very well written. Well, anyway, that was tonight's show. I want to thank everybody for listening, and tell your friends, tell your family. And also, don't forget my new book, Naked at the Mic, The Survival of a Liberal in a Time of Peril. It just got its first review today by Hank Garbarelli, the author, and it's up on Amazon.com, so you can check that out, Amazon.com. Look on the book. Click right on that book, and the book, and you'll see the and scroll down, and you'll see the review. It'll say it's got a 5-star review, so very good. So I want to thank everybody. Don't forget, Naked at the Mic, Survival of a Liberal in a Time of Peril, on Amazon.com. You can also look at Barnes & Noble as well, but the review is on Amazon. So I wish everybody a good night, and thanks.